the first 6 steps, right? First 5 steps. 1 through 5. If you're Christian.
My name is Clancy Emerson. I'm an alcoholic. Now that you've had an hour and a half away from my droning voice, we'll try it again. Well, this afternoon we're going to talk about the steps. I should say going in that I am not in that school of thought. There are people who are able to talk about the steps and their deep psychological meaning and what they really mean. But I'm not one of those. I'm one of those people who, I'm a subscriber to what Dr. Bob said of keep it simple. And to me, the simplicity of the Alcoholics Anonymous 12 steps, the reason we have to make them complex when we're new is because we're so complex we can't believe that simple program like that could help us. But as you stay sober longer, it gets simpler and simpler as you develop various reactions. I would say that in my opinion of the steps I know, the first 3 steps have probably kept more people drunk than anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, probably, in my opinion, in my experience. Because people come here and the first 3 steps just don't make sense. Because the first step, you're going to admit you're an alcoholic, and I'm not really an alcoholic. Then you're going to return to God. And if you're like me, I don't want to return to God. I want to stay out of sight if possible. Then you're going to turn your problems over to God and try that some morning when you can't pay your rent and you'll sleep on the street. And they don't seem to have any answer for people like me whose case is different, who knows that my problem really isn't alcohol, although sometimes it is. But I know it really is all these other things that make me feel different, all these strange feelings and so on. And you come to admit you're an alcoholic and I'm not really an alcoholic. I've got something wrong with me. There's no question about that. I've known that since I was 5 years old. But I'm not an alcoholic. And that's why it takes a while sometimes to be around here and come to realize that the Alcoholics Anonymous steps say none of the things I just said about them. None of them say anything like that. My sponsor, who was rather cruel to me many times because I wanted to debate with him, but he pointed that out to me, I remember years ago, saying such things as, listen, you, why don't you just try the black parts of the page? You know, just the words that are on the page. We're not interested in your goddamn opinions. And I was so upset I didn't talk to him for a day or two. Really punished him. But the first step, people, you hear that a lot, people say, I couldn't make the first step. I was drinking because I couldn't make the first step. As if to say the first step says that you're going to admit you're an alcoholic, you're going to stop drinking. And the first step doesn't say that. The first step is really quite clear and quite simple. The whole thing is so simple. I'm going to talk this afternoon and just how simple these things are, which sounds a contradiction in terms. But the first step says, this was pointed out to me, and I'll point out to those of you who are maybe new, it never says you're an alcoholic. It says you admitted that you were powerless over alcohol. What does that mean? Does that mean every time you drank, you got crazy and leaped on nuns and did unspeakable things to them? No, but it sounds like a good idea now that I think about it. I shouldn't say that. What AA asks you and me to admit when we come here? That we're having trouble with our drinking. That we no longer can control it on a continuing basis. That when you drink, sometimes you cannot predict your behavior. We talked about that earlier today. That it isn't that every time you drink, your hair grows long and you become a fiend, but that sometimes you drink. One of the problems I had in my life was that I could stop after work and drink, and feel good and go home. But other times, I couldn't. And I never knew when the couldn't was going to be. Oh, that was the night of my daughter's birthday. Oh, that's the night I should have been home. Or that's the night I was supposed to do. You just never know. And like that analogy we used this morning about the playing Russian roulette. there's a lot of clicks when you're starting out you can get by with, but eventually the chambers get filled up and they get worse and worse. And all you got to admit when you come here, I'm having some trouble drinking. And we presume if you weren't having some trouble drinking, you wouldn't come here. People usually don't come to Alcoholics Anonymous if they don't have a problem drinking, unless they happen to be one of those people who want to sneak in. God, Bill and Dr. Bob would roll over in the grave if that people wanted to sneak into AA. But, you know, but there are people who come to meetings and they presume it means more than that. And they think that you have to admit that you're the worst alcoholic ever. And it doesn't say that at all. The analogy I always think about that is this woman who came to the doctor to take a pregnancy test. And she said, well, now there's no reason to think so, doctor. I've never been touched, but while I'm here, could I have one of those rabbit tests? Okay. And Dr. Joyce says, I've got some wonderful news for you, Miss Brown. Mrs. Brown? She says, oh, I'm not Mrs. Brown. I'm Miss Brown. She says, I've got some bad news for you, Miss Brown. You're pregnant. She says, but it can't be, doctor. I told you, I've never been touched. I've always been a very perfect girl. He said, that may be, ma'am, but you're pregnant. She said, it can't be. I tell you, I can't. The doctor walked over to a window. She says, what are you doing that for? He says, the last time this happened, there was a star in the east, and I don't want to miss it. You know. People will sit in AA meetings and deny they've had any trouble drinking at all. But they're not saying that. They're denying that they're not extreme to the extremes they hear. They haven't been in jail 42 times or been in 19 treatment centers or something. But it doesn't ask you to admit that. It asks you to admit, I'm having some problems drinking. And a lot of other problems too, but I'm having problems drinking. And therefore, my life is unmanageable. But it doesn't say that either. My sponsor had to point that out. He says, you're supposed to be a writer. You told me you're a world great writer. Read the first step. See what it says. It says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, dash. And the English language, dash means end of thought, beginning of new thought. You're admitting two things. That you've had problem. You cannot control your drinking as you wish. And you're also, your life is unmanageable when you're sober. And both of these would have to be present to be here. Why would anyone ever, when you walk in the door here, you make that admission. You don't have to admit it to anybody. It's very clear, because if either one of those things weren't present, I wouldn't be here. If drinking wasn't a problem, and my sobriety was a problem, today I would be out drinking. I wouldn't be here. I'd be drinking. I'd be having fun. If my drinking was out of hand, but I could live comfortably sober, I wouldn't be here. I'd be out living comfortably sober. It's when you cannot exist in either place. I'm having problems drinking. I'm having problems sober. And that's what makes you crazy, because you know it's not all the alcohol. It's all these other things. But the nice thing about this is, that's all you have to admit. You do not have to admit, really, in that step, it doesn't say to admit you're an alcoholic. You don't even have to agree to stay sober. You just have to admit, I'm having some problems drinking, I'm having some problems sober. But I'd like to tell you why. But I don't know why. Thank you very much. You know. That's all there is to the first step. As you go along later, in late, you know, if you get bored some years later and you want to look into reasons why, is the body having this sensitivity reaction to alcohol? Why is my sobriety full of conflict? You may find those reasons. They're easy to find. But to take the first step of AA is this. I'm having problems drinking. I'm having problems sober. And that's the first step, and that's all it says, and that's all it asks. And if you do that, you are actually saying, I have alcoholism, because that's the definition of alcoholism. Intolerable drinking, intolerable sobriety. That's the definition of alcoholism. So there's nothing really to debate there. The second step drives a lot of people away. It drove me away for a long time. Because now you're going to return to God. And I was raised in a very religious place up in northern Wisconsin, the Norwegian Lutheran Church. Very strict. Our sinners became Southern Baptists. Incidentally, I want to tell you something. I think I mentioned this morning, I woke up this morning about 4:30 and I couldn't sleep. I had a terrible time. And it just struck me why. Because where I'm staying in that area, there's a whole big convention of Southern Baptists, isn't there? And that hotel is full of Southern Baptists. And I woke up at 4:30 in the morning and the silence was deafening. Nobody in the distance said, "Oh, son of a bitch, come on, honey, I want you to your drinks put out," you know. Where I come from, deafening silence is you can't sleep for that. That's why I couldn't sleep. I happen to think about that. But anyway, I was raised in a strict church, and it's a very strict church, and we were taught as children that, there are certain rules you follow. You don't sin. You don't associate with Catholics. You try to live a good life. And as I got a little bit older, I realized that I seemed to be different than most of the Norwegian Lutherans somehow. I seemed to need more fun than other Norwegian Lutheran kids. And I got sinning. Then I got monking with Catholics. Then I got sinning with Catholics, actually. Which was a lot easier than I thought it would be. But rather, I knew I was in trouble by the time I was 12, or 13, or 14. By the time I was 18, I realized if what they said was true, I was going to go to hell. And I stopped trying to believe in the Lutheran Church. Because if what they say is true. And there's something about that, you know, the effect of, like Hitler used to say, you give me your minds till you're 12, but they'll be Nazis till they're 90, somewhere down and deep inside. And I was trained in a frame of goodness, and I liked it really, but I just couldn't do it. And I always knew I could, when I grew up, I got to be kind of a smart-talking agnostic or atheist, or sit around with other boobs and porches and say things like, "If God exists, let him strike me dead." If God exists, why does a train hit a busload of nuns outside of Chicago and leave them strung along the track like a bunch of dead penguins, and 20 miles away, gangsters live in luxury and go to Italy, and Lucky Luciano sits in Naples with his prostitutes and booze and drugs and terrible man living comfortably, and 100 miles away in Rome, the Pope is screaming in pain from cancer. Is this God in action? Forget it. And that's all very good, except once in a while you wake up in the middle of the night and you know you're going to go to hell. You're going to go to hell. And you can't, as I said, you can't fool them at 2 in the morning. And so one of the things I hated about God, about AA, my years of slipping, sometimes I'd start to just get stays over a little bit, and then one of these God people would start talking. Got to return to God now. Turn to God. Remember one time in Chicago or someplace, I had delivered a small statement on my disbelief in God. Some little lady came up to me, she says, "Oh, Sonny," she said, "we just hate to see you fight God." I remember thinking, it's all I could do to keep from saying, "Well, ma'am, you'll never see me fight God again." You know, now you can just hear me fight God for a while. And I could stay around AA a little bit, but I'm not much of one for returning to God. I remember my sponsor, after another one of my expositions at a meeting in Los Angeles, he wasn't there, but somebody told him about it. God, I hate... That's one thing I hate about my sponsor. He seemed to have snitches in every meeting in the world. But he cornered me, and a couple other people cornered me, and they pointed out to me that... I'm synthesizing what he's saying. He said, "For God's sakes, AA doesn't say you have to return to God." And I said, "Oh, okay. Return to a power greater than myself? Does that fool your little friends? It doesn't fool me. I know who they're talking about." He says, "No, it doesn't say that either."
Why don't you read the steps for Christ's sake? Should you come to believe? You come to believe in something, that there's a power greater than yourself. Can't you believe in God?
I said, no.
She says, can't you believe in AA?
I said, no.
He says, you think I'm doing better than you are?
I said, I guess so.
He says, congratulations, I'm your new higher power.
And that's how we became my higher power, I talked about this morning. And as I said this morning, I could accept that because he couldn't send me to hell. It seemed like hell sometimes, but it wasn't. And I accepted him as my higher power. And as I repeat what I said this morning, people say, oh, look at that guy. His sponsor's his God. And sponsor was not God, but come to believe in a power greater. You got to come to, that step says you got to come to believe there's a power greater than yourself. I remember telling my sponsor one time, I don't believe there's a power greater than myself. He says, I can prove that different. And I said, how? He said, go out under the lamppost, take off all your clothes, and stand on the street corner. You'll see a power greater than yourself in a black and white car come and take you away. They don't care if you believe in him or not. That's one of the great problems of the world. It's full of powers greater than myself. The problem is to come to believe in a power greater than myself that may be benevolent. So I got to, and the nice thing about it is this. You don't have to understand how any of these things are going to happen. You just have to try to come to believe in something. And what is this power that I'm going to try to believe in? What's it going to do? It's going to restore me to sanity. Well, there's a little problem there. What is sanity? Who can define sanity? You can read 10 psychiatric textbooks and you will not find an agreement on what sanity is. I used to think sanity, the guy that I was measured by, was the guy in the next bed to mine in the electric shock ward in Texas, where we were confined against our will. And he used to be happy all the time. Say, how are you doing this morning, Frank? Just fine, just fine. Lovely morning, isn't it? Nothing. God, that's sanity. And I started to realize he's never going to get out of there unless he stops laughing. I mean, that isn't it. Being happy all the time is not sanity. What is sanity? Well, it's hard to define sanity. Insanity, however, is easy to define. That can be defined in any textbook. Psychosis. In the insanity not caused by brain damage, but caused by psychological difficulty. And psychosis is oversimplified, but it's basically this. When conflict of the mind, we all have conflicts. When the conflicts sometimes get out of whack, get out so intense, can't cope with them. Sometimes the neurosis is so intense, they just get so self-centered that the brain, in an effort to maintain itself, to sustain itself, to maintain itself, will set up an exit. In other words, it'll make part of the perceived reality different than it is. It'll alter perception of reality to change to reduce the conflict. An example of that. Instead of worrying, what are these people all talking about? Why are they talking about, on those phones, why are they talking to each other? And a form of psychosis. I now know why they're talking. They're talking about me. They're plotting against me. Which is a relief. I know it gets rid of the conflict. It may make me sick, but I understand why they're doing it now. The conflict removed. And much of psychosis is the same thing. Sometimes it's just a little bit. Sometimes it's the whole thing. These people are always locked up. But a lot of people have brief psychoses, and they're not locked up because it only manifests itself when the right situation comes up. That's why you find these serial, sometimes crazed killers. Their neighbors all say, God, he's such a nice guy. Very pleasant in the neighborhood. He just had a tendency to cut off his wife's head, I guess. I don't know. Yeah. When the right buttons are pushed. Okay. Psychosis is it's when your brain will change your perception of reality to reduce conflict. Now, here's an interesting thing. Alcoholics almost never become psychotic. The cases of alcoholics becoming psychotic are so rare as to be almost non-existent. Now, isn't that strange? You think, they talk about people dying from alcoholic insanity. And they do. Alcoholic insanity is the second cause of death. Maybe the first cause of death, because a lot of alcoholism deaths are not listed as alcoholism when you slide across the center line or where you commit suicide or do a lot of things. But alcoholic insanity itself is not a mental condition. It's a physical condition. Everyone in this room that's ever been drunk, and I assume we all have been drunk, is familiar with that fundamental thing of waking up in the morning and having a terrible thirst, having the fire, got to get the fire out. Jesus, get something cold, some beer or water, something, you know. Oh. And the reason for that is because alcohol is the only substance that I know, the only fluid I know that dries out your body. It is a dehydrating substance. It goes, gets into the bloodstream and dries out cells throughout the body. And that's why you get up and you're so thirsty and you have to induce fluids, which again revive the cells. But there are two areas of the body, two organs, in which cells are dead like that. They never revive. When cells are dead, they're dead. One is the liver, one is the brain. And that is why people like us die with liver problems, and that's why we have brain problems. Now, it doesn't mean that these things suddenly just stop working. It means you got millions of cells. It takes a lot of drinking over a long period of time, but eventually you can, well, we know cirrhosis of the liver. Cirrhosis of the liver is caused not even so much by drinking and not getting sufficient vitamins to revive the cells. In other words, to protect the cells. But in the brain, it's all alcohol. You lose enough brain cells and you have alcoholic insanity, also called Korsakoff syndrome, also caused in a wet brain, but it really is a dry brain. It's ironic. And I'll tell you, you may think that you see people on the means, and Christ, that's somebody's got a wet brain, so acting so crazy. But people with this condition, you won't see them at meetings, and you won't see them acting silly in bars, because they're not there. Where you'll never, probably most of you will never see a case of it. I see them all the time, and I wish I didn't. People with dried out alcoholic brains are sitting in a ward, they're sitting on a bed or on a chair, and they come and change their diapers three times a day, and they feed them, and they put them to bed, and they get them up, and they feed them, and they change their diapers. And this goes on day after day, after week, after month, after year. It's very much like the last stages of syphilis, except syphilis has the decency to kill the patient. In alcoholic insanity, you can sit like that. The rest of your body's healthy. You can last 40 years sometimes, 40, 50 years. But once a year, your family will come down, hoping against hope you'll know them. And you don't, so they cry and go home. That's what alcoholic insanity is. But alcoholics never, if ever, become psychotic. They become alcoholic, Korsakoff syndrome, but not psychosis, where your brain is, why? Because when it gets bad enough, long enough, I will drink alcohol and alter my perception of reality. A very excellent case could be, I'd debate all day. As an alcoholic, I can induce temporary psychosis. I can change reality. And I have the ability to do that, and so I will not ever be confronted where the brain strives against it. And I will do it again and again. That's what this book talks about, in that phrase where it says there seem to be time when there's no adequate defense against the first drink. You're not even aware of it, but you are drinking to preserve your sanity. Sometimes when it's bad. Now, what do you think it means it's going to restore me to sanity? Maybe it means just exactly what it would say. That somehow it's going to restore me to living in a world where I do not have to induce psychosis to stand it. Where I do not have to induce temporary insanity to weather the conflicts. And it isn't going to do it by making my mind stronger. It's going to do it by finding ways where I can reduce the conflict. Somehow. We were talking at lunch today about willpower. Why can't I do these same things with willpower? Well, you know, the brain has the power, the power of the human will, and much of my life has been spent, I'm sure much of your life, in dealing with emotions that seem to get so strong and out of hand and get me in problems If I could just, damn it, keep those damn emotions in check, a lot of times I'd be all right. And there's always a conflict between these two. And as the years go by, as I get more intense, I'll tell you a little truism. When intense emotions are in battle against the power of the mind, the will, the emotions eventually always win. And that's why the brain gets tired and walks away, and here you go. And it's very difficult. You come to AA and you think, well, maybe AA is going to somehow strengthen my will, strengthen my power to control these damn emotions. And it does for a while, but eventually the emotions win. And yet there are people who have learned to do this. How do you do this? Why is this? And it turns out it's a very strange thing. You only see it in retrospect, really. AA offers very little to my brain, very little to my conscious knowledge, except in retrospect. What AA does is have me take actions that reduce the pressure of the emotions, coming at it from the other direction. So I eventually am able to control my emotions, not by strengthening my will, but by reducing the intensity of the emotions to reduce that conflict. So, somehow I got to come to believe, somehow, in some way, I can't see how it can do it, but you don't have to know how you're going to do it. You have to just believe by looking at people ahead of you that have done it. That somehow there's a power, I don't know what it is, my sponsor, meetings, Jesus, I hope it's not God, is going to restore me to being able to live in the world without having to drink to stand it. I can't see how that can be, because they can't possibly understand how much pain I have. But the nice thing about it is you don't have to understand anything about it. All you have to do is try to come to believe that a power greater than yourself, whatever that power may be, will restore you to sanity. You can try to come to believe that, you've just taken the second step. That's all there is to it. That's all it says. That's all it says in the second step. You don't have to see how it's going to be done. So now I've got some problems drinking. I got some problems sober that make me eventually have to drink. And I've got to somehow come to believe there's some power here. Seems ridiculous. Is going to enable me to be able to live in the world without having a drink to stand it. But Jesus, I don't know how. But you'll have to know how. Third step's quite simple. This is one that drives a lot of people away. You're going to turn your problems over to God. Now, you and I both know that doesn't work. That's ridiculous. That's nice for old, good people, maybe. Well, I took my problem to Jesus, and I didn't have any rent money. I went to Jesus, and the next day a check came in the mail from an old insurance policy. I knew the program worked. God, that used to make me crazy to hear stories like that. I remember one time in my slipping days, I heard a guy talking. He says, I was riding in the club car of this train, and I was having a few drinks, and suddenly almost I heard a voice say, put that drink down and go back to your Pullman. I thought, what does this mean? But I went back to my Pullman, and an hour later that train derailed and the people in the club car were killed. And I knew that God was teaching me a lesson about my drinking. And my reaction is, what is God teaching those poor bastards in the club car? How to die just so you can feel better? Screw that. If God is like that, I don't want any part of it. I don't go for this God stuff. I can't accept that. Because if God is judging people on their worthiness and merits, I am screwed. I'm not even going to think about that. And you go to meetings, hear people say, I'm here by the grace of God. Which implies the other people out there don't have the grace of God, I guess. And God's going through the world saying, you can stay sober, you can't. You can, but you too can't. You can, maybe you can, I'm not sure yet. No, yeah. If that's the case, I can't stay sober, because I would never be the one anybody would choose, because I'm a sinner, bad, loser, failure, dreadful person. And I could not accept the fact that turn my will and my life over to the care of God. That's ridiculous. I would not do that. I went along in AA for a while, and I was about 6 months sober. I was staying sober somehow, off and on, mostly by being intimidated by my sponsor, and an occasional pat on the back. And I got a job as a dishwasher. I'd had other jobs I'd lost. A guy put in some clout and got me a job as a dishwasher, which is not really what you should have to have after 6 months sobriety, to have clout to get a job as a dishwasher. And I lasted about 2 days at that Gaiety Delicatessen on Sunset. I got thinking about that. I was watching. It seemed to me the waiters, the busboys, were bringing in more dishes than the waiters were taking out. And I began to deduce these waiters are getting dishes in other restaurants to humiliate me because I'm an Anglo. I stacked a few dishes that didn't seem to be our dishes over there, and I wouldn't do them. They take these dishes back where you got them, Jose. And turns out I misjudged. They were our dishes, but the boss came up to the end of the meeting and said, today he said, I have to let you go tonight, kid. Of course, by this time I'd been around AA sober 6 months, so I'd learned some of the AA patter that I hadn't picked up in all the other years I was slipping. Yeah. Oh, I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm trying to find a new life. You got to give me another chance. I'm working 12 steps and I'm finding a new life and I'm making a change in my life. And he said something very true. He said, I don't give a shit about all that. You just don't wash your dishes. That's all. And I thought about that many, many times since then. A lot of times when I didn't feel like getting up and going to work, so I was up helping somebody in the middle of the night, or I was tired, or I'd driven all the way to India to talk to 10 Indians and come back, and these other people just went home and watched television. I'm tired. I should be able to come in early. And I always think, people out there, they don't care what I did last night. They just want me to wash my dishes, you know. Be where you said you're going to be there. God, that's hurtful, but it's really true. But anyway, I got fired. I lost my job, and I decided to commit suicide. And I didn't know what else to do. I thought, I'll just kill myself. I've always been good on suicide. I've tried to commit suicide so many times I started to damage my health. But I decided to throw myself in the ocean that day. And I started walking out there, and I walked so far, geez, I got tired. I stopped the guy and said, where's the ocean? He says, well, you're just in Western Beverly Hills. You have to go out past the Veterans Hospital and about another 3 miles after that. I'm not going to do that. And I called up my sponsor, and I said, Jesus, Bob, what am I going to do? He says, why don't you write your damn inventory? Like I told you. And I had just told him the week before, I've taken my inventory with a psychiatrist. Why do I want to take it with an out-of-work actor? What good's that going to do for me? You know? That made him cross. Everything made him cross. I said, my judgment, Bob, that's the last thing in the world I need. My God, I'm so full of remorse and pain and agony. I have no place to, in my judgment. He says, in your judgment? Who cares about your judgment? You live in an abandoned car, for Christ's sake. If I wanted your judgment, I'd put my head in the back window and ask you for it. You know, that's a hurtful thing to say to a sensitive guy. He got me so upset that day that I went back in. I jumped out of that telephone. It's a good thing I turned left. I'd have made the ocean in 3 bounds on the other way, but I got back to the A Club. I said, Sullivan, give me some paper. I'm going to write my inventory. I wrote, oh, God, I wrote terrible things I've never told anybody. Just, oh, I was so upset. And people said to me, why would you tell your psychiatrist these things? Because when you're paying that kind of money, you can't risk rejection. That's why. I don't want the guy to say, you did what, sir? Get out of my office and first wash off that chair, you know. And I took an inventory. And a week later, I was feeling bad again, and he took me for a ride along the ocean from Santa Monica to Oxnard, about 40 miles, and gave me a flashlight. And had me read it to him. By that time, I was feeling I'd really want to, not sure I want to talk about all of these things. Just read it. And I read these terrible things, and by the time I got to Oxford, I thought, he's going to make me get out of his car and maybe turn me into the police for all I know. And the old fool was just yawning. I thought I'd made him crazy. But I've taken that trip over 200 times since then, on the driver's side. And some other puke over there with a flashlight.
Let me explain this part before I read it. You know. And it's an amazing thing. They're all the same. But I look back and I realize, I suppose that's when I took the third step. When I surrendered my will to do something I absolutely didn't want to do because I was in such pain. Nothing helps you, I don't think, surrender quite as much as pain. Love is nice, but you get strong by pain and overcoming pain. I look back now and I think to myself, I came to surrender to a power greater than myself and I allowed him to do it by taking a fourth step. I suppose a fourth step probably is the great dividing line, always will be in Alcoholics Anonymous, between people who are going to do it and people who are postponing it. The fourth step is, and they have different ways of doing it, they have that diagram in the book, which is good. That was the state of the art in 1939, when he 38 when he wrote the book, and maybe now. Over the years, I've listed on inventories, and I've, for my own personal use, I have, for the people I sponsor, I've worked out some questions that I ask them to answer thoroughly, and then discover that if they're like me, they'll have written a good inventory. There's nothing deep psychological things, just questions are things like, one, in looking back over your life today, what memories are still painful, are still guilty, are still dirty? Two, today, in what ways do you feel inadequate as a person? Be it. Three, who do you resent and why? Be as specific as possible and nasty to really show what you really feel. Four, what do you conceive to be your defects of character as far as you can determine? Five, what is the nature of your ongoing problems you have with people close to you, your family, people you love, and so on? What seems to be the recurring things that happen? Six, what are your goals today as you see them, realistic or not? Just list what are your goals as far as you can see. And seven, do you see that any way that AA can begin to help you start toward these goals? And if you write, in my experience, if you write those things and thoroughly, some of them write many, many pages just on the first question, you'll have written a good inventory. One of the great problems with an inventory is knowing what to write. Because so often you sit down and you wind up with a biography, a 40-page biography, not what we're trying to get. We're trying to, as the step says, we're trying to find out our defects of character. We're trying to make an inventory of ourselves so we can evaluate how we are. And to do that is not, I'll tell you something, if you're thinking about taking an inventory, an inventory is not supposed to make you feel better. If you've taken an inventory, it should make you feel worse. Because you're confronting all sorts of crap that you've been burying and ignoring and putting aside. You get done that inventory and think, oh, Jesus. And then you take hopefully you take a fifth step. Some people are so ashamed of their fourth step, they never take a fifth step, which is just the absolute opposite of what you should do, because you're not going to feel good after the fourth step. If you feel good, it's going to be after the fifth step. And yet people are so afraid of this, they're so convinced they are different that they're afraid to read their inventory or afraid to write it down even. But then you take a fifth step, and now I know different people do it different ways. Some parts of the country they have clergymen where everybody goes and takes their inventory with that clergyman. Some people go 100 miles to talk to a priest that they don't know, right, to take their inventory. Some people have counselors. Where I live, it is the custom to take an inventory with your sponsor. And they say, well, gee, what if my, you know, should I put my hands on the hands of a person who might get drunk and blab about it? I've never heard of that happening, ever, ever. But I'm asking this guy to save my life and to give me direction to save my life, but I'm not willing him to tell him about myself. Now, isn't that stupid? He's supposed to give me directions without me giving him any data except what I choose he needs to have. So I think you take an inventory with your sponsor. And theoretically what happens is you take your fifth step. After you take your fifth step, he or she
shares a little bit with you to help you understand you're nowhere near as different as you fear.
I suppose that's the greatest fear of everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous, or outside of Alcoholics Anonymous, who's an alcoholic. But I am different. My case is different. I'm just different. Discover the greatest gift in AA is to discover you're not so different little by little, and suddenly to realize you're just like everybody else. As I talked about this morning, I've been to meetings, over the years I've been coming to ask to speak in exotic places like Cape Town, South Africa, and Australia. I'll be there again in a couple months, and Berlin, and Paris, and Ireland. Last September I went to Norway. God, was that wonderful. I was in a town, first time I was ever in a place where there was a majority of Norwegian Lutherans, and I felt strong. We found a little old Catholic lady and just kicked the hell out of her. She was plotting something, I could tell. She was fingering some beads of some kind. But it's an amazing thing. It's an amazing thing. You always kind of, you think you find exotic AA and exotic people, and except for the accents, you hear exactly the same thing I hear in Los Angeles. The same things, the same feelings, the same troubles, the same cares, the same. I remember sitting in, I was in Berlin about 3 weeks after the wall came down. And I, as a fact, I went up to that wall, and they gave me a little hammer and a chipper, and I chipped off pieces of the wall, and I brought them home and gave them to my grandsons, and said, "Here, John and Joe, this is proof that I love you more than your other grandfather does." Well, I got to do everything I can. Usually I just give them money and tell them that. But anyway. But, you know, and I sat in there, and I was supposed to be able to speak at a dinner on Saturday night. I was there for a Friday night English-speaking meeting, and they had some Germans come in from East Germany. They even had two guys from Czechoslovakia there who'd come for that weekend. And that was funny. Let me tell you, Mr. Pat told me I got off the subject this morning, and I told him to shut up. Anyway. But just as an aside thing, in Czechoslovakia, up until the wall, there was AA. But as they explained to us, there were a series of little groups, and they each had only two people in them. And I said, "Why would you only have two people?" He said, "Because under the laws of the state, any group of three or more who discussed God was a conspiracy against the state. So you could have two people in your group." I thought to myself, that wouldn't be bad if I was the old timer. You come, set up both chairs, make coffee, I'll come and speak, then you clean up. Again and again and again. But I spoke in Berlin, and I thought, you know, I'll hear something, because there were East Germans there coming through the gate where they used to spies used to get together. You're going to hear about freedom, freedom from alcohol, and freedom from Soviet tyranny, and freedom from fear. And I was so thrilled, I heard a voice behind me say, "But I don't think you really understand. I'm afraid my case is different." Of course, I could have heard that in Santa Monica. I didn't have to go to Germany to hear that. And that's what's so important about a fourth and fifth step of getting this stuff out, because you start to realize eventually that you're not so different. All these things are to overcome difference. I suppose the fourth step is a great turning spot, not because of anything except that I cannot believe that this filth is not unique unto me. And that's where the third step comes in. That is where you do the third step by doing the fourth step. That's because what you're saying in effect is this: I can't drink. I'm having trouble drinking, having trouble sober. Somewhere there's a power greater than me that's going to restore me to sanity. I can't see what it could be. But then I'm going to do what that power says, whether I agree with it or not. That is the crisis point. Everybody can talk, but am I willing to do something that I'm afraid of, that I know is going to make me look bad, going to make me look unnatural, they're going to find out about me, I can't trust anybody, and do it anyway, just because people ahead of me who I can admire say I should. And that's all it takes. That first three steps that I think keep people out of here
are really quite simple.
Admit I have some problem drinking. Admit I have some problem sober. Somewhere there's a power here. I don't know if it's that light pole out there, or my sponsor, or God, or Jesus, who knows, that will enable me to not have to drink to stand it. And as frightening as it is, I'm going to try it. And it's a funny thing, we come here with desperation and think that's so terrible, yet the desperation is the best friend you got. The desperation will make you do things you'd never do for love or mommy or nobody else. And you take these actions. And you write a fearless and thorough moral inventory. There are people who say, around AA, they say, well, you shouldn't just have an inventory of your bad things, you should have the good things. Maybe just write an inventory of positive things. And maybe you should. But there's no step to take care of that. The fifth step just deals with the nature of our wrongs. I guess we'll have to write a new step. And then to admire the nature of my rights, I guess. It is to unload this crap. We don't have to tell each other, I'm not so bad. That's why, in my experience, when I work with people, when I find out they're 4 or 5, or usually 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 months sober, there's a period they go through. Most people, you get depressed. They're sick of all this AA shit, and you're restless and discontent and don't feel good. That's when I say, take an inventory. And I give them those questions. Because you write a lot better inventory when you feel rotten than you do when you feel good. When you feel good, you say, well, I guess I've done a few bad things, but all in all, I've been a pretty decent sort, and I'm glad to be here at AA. Thank you very much. But when you're crazy and suicidal, I'm a dirty son of a bitch, and you get that crap out. And so that's, to me, the foundation of AA. And yet, that isn't AA, because if that's all there was to AA, we would get that in psychoanalysis. Because this, what we've talked about so far, is what psychoanalysis is. Of coming to believe you got a problem, of going to see a power greater than yourself, and talking about it. What makes AA different is that after that is when recovery begins. In psychoanalysis, you've now ended at the conversation stage. But in AA, you have just established the problem and will do something about it as the days and weeks and months ahead come over. So all I'm saying, in effect, is you got to remember, the steps of AA are quite simple. They mean what they say, and if you do these 5 things, you'll be in a position to start to get better. Thank you. Are there any questions on the first 5 steps? Don't feel bad. Don't feel ill at ease. If you say something that makes you sound silly, I'll turn on you. What? Thank you very much. That's a good question. Let me explain how that comes about. I was born in a trunk in the Princess Theater. And
my question is, how come the steps are written in the past tense?
How come the steps are written in the past tense? Because they're talking. They had taken them already when they wrote them. Pat, get the car started. I'll be out in a minute. What? It was written, the 12 and 12 was written in 1954. 15 years. But why would that have, she's talking about why were the steps written in the past tense? As they are there, written in the book. Go to your room. Oh. Anybody else that can share anything? I don't have to ask you a question. You want to share something? I get the feeling I know what Daddy Warbucks looks like, looking at a whole room of orphan Annie's, just round circles for eyes. Huh? What?
Okay, what if you got somebody you're sponsoring and you're just like going for months and months and months and months on the fourth step? What do you think?
Well, that isn't very unnatural, very unusual. in my experience, when I have people like that, I have people like that from time to time, I do, just do not listen to their recitation of troubles anymore. They look at me funny. I don't give a shit. Write your inventory. Like my sponsor said to me, you know, I'm going to kill myself. Write your inventory. And then you have to decide, what will I do? I'll flip a coin. Kill myself, write my inventory. They're equally... But that isn't so unusual. What do you do when you have people who won't write your inventory? Maggie?
The exact same thing. I just tell them, well, just don't tell me the problems you're having between now and when you start.
Yeah, I just said that.
That's the answer.
But, you know, but there are people like that because they're always afraid. You know, they're just instinctively afraid. I know all the reasons why I should, but I just can't. Yes, sir?
How many people do you know that say spoken?
Not very many. I know that. I'll tell you an example of that. I know people who stayed sober. When I was about 5 years sober, and I had a guy about 6 months ago, I was trying to get taken into it. We went to a meeting one night, and a guy named Larry Blake, I think his name was talking. He was 23 years sober. He said, "You got to take your inventory." This guy said, "There are people around here who tell you you have to write an inventory." Well, I didn't write a damn inventory. And I've been sober 23 years. And I'm tired of hearing that kind of talk. On the way home, this kid says to me, "Geez, you know, you say you have to write an inventory. And he says I didn't. He's 23 years sober. Why should I listen to you?" And I had no answer. I said, I'll get back to you. And in the middle of the night, the answer came, and I called him in the morning. I said, "I knew the answer all along. I just didn't want to tell you last night. I wanted you to think about it." I said, "You look at the way he feels. Is that the way you want to feel when you're 23 years sober? I know how to feel that way sober when I was sober 2 days." "No." "Yes, I'm sober." There are old timers all over AA who's, "You have to do all this crap. You come here and you stop drinking. You go to meetings. You hear that? And you'll find love, you son of a bitch." I don't know. I would say this, in my opinion, I don't know any alcoholics of our type who would stay sober and feel good without getting some of that crap out. There may be people who do for the Chick Shadell or someplace like that, but not of our type. Yes, sir. No, I didn't say you should. I said I do, and on my part of the country we do that. But
the only question I had was that I did do my fifth step with my sponsor, but I can't admit that I did hold some things back for the fact that there are things that I think I'd rather tell somebody who will never see me again.
We all have things like that, kid. That's what you tell your sponsor. You're not telling your sponsor is acting as God for. You know, it's like going to a priest. I don't want to tell the priest that. I don't mind telling God. When you're in that confessional, God is acting through the priest. I believe God works through your sponsor. He may not even know it. I don't mean that he's a wonderful God-like creature, but that's the way I think that is exactly what we're talking about this morning. I understand that fear better than you know, and I also know that it's better to do it than to sit around feeling bad waiting for the right person to tell it to. And you might just call and say, "I got a few things I'd like to mention to you. I twist baby chickens' necks." "I used to be married to a sheep outside of Butte, Montana." Things that you just do not have generally known in the population. Yes, sir.
I've heard different stories about people saying how long their first step was.
Length of the fourth step? No, I know people who are troubled who write long. That's why I put those questions out, so at least there's some delineation of what's... Because I think the real long inventory gets to be one of two things. Either an interminable biography or going over the same things again and again and again and again and again. And both of them might be good for the person. It makes the listener crazy after a while, you know. I don't know. I would say that
It's impossible to say. I've listened to inventories that were 5 pages long that were just really pretty much, and also inventories 20 pages long that really didn't have any more in them than they did. I just think you have to write down the things that are bothering you. And if it takes 10 pages to do it, good. If it takes 20 pages, just don't tell me the same thing over and over again, like that old story about the woman going to confession and talking about being raped by 3 men, and the father said, when did this happen? She said, 41 years ago. He said, you don't have to keep confessing it. She said, I just like to think about it. Yeah. It's the same thing. You just get it out and shut it down. Come on, give me another question, or else I'll have to have some more coffee. Could I write down those questions?
Yeah,
for a dollar. That's why I went through them fast. I figured there'd be somebody here who could remember them. I'll be glad to talk to you later. They're not from Bill Wilson's forehead. They're just my experience that I've found helps. Because one of the hardest things about writing an inventory is sitting down and putting the pencil on the paper and knowing what to write. Because you just don't know what. I better not say that. I was born, if you have specific essay questions to answer, well, I'll tell you what, it makes it a lot easier. All right, Bill. Come in and join the silent meditation, sir. I'm going to tell you something about that question right now. When someone says, I've been around this program about 16 years, the immediate question is, how long have you been sober this time?
Three months,
okay. Because that's the line I used all my life. I've been around about 9 years. How long have you been sober? 2 days. You know. Sorry, I'm not putting you down for it. I'm just explaining it.
I've done many forms.
Well, maybe you're not acting. Maybe it's not in the fourth step. I mean, the fourth step gives you identification, but then you have to start doing something about it. A fourth step will not keep you sober, nor will a fifth step. The ensuing steps, the amends, the making amends, the going through being of service to others, that's where you stay sober. The fourth and fifth step just gets that shit out, you know. If the fourth and fifth step kept you sober, psychiatry would keep you sober. Well, we're going to talk a little more about this afternoon when we talk about the rest of the steps, and then we'll talk about it. I'm not at all putting you down. You understand that? You remind me of me, so get out of here. Anybody else? Okay, folks. I'm buying the drinks.